number 09-SC-966, Larson Sandberg versus Sinclair Transportation Company, doing business as Sinclair Pipeline Company. Are both parties present, ready?
Yes, sir.
Just to repeat, the housekeeping measure I mentioned earlier, in the earlier argument, Justice Designee Marquez will not, is not here, obviously. She won't be joining the court until December 10th, absent any form of conflict that she will determine. She will participate in the decision of this case by listening to the tapes in a normal process. With that, our argument is set for 30 minutes per side, and I'd appreciate it if you would please state your name and whom you represent at the time, at the opening of your argument. So we're ready to hear from the petitioners.
Hey, please, the court. Ben Cohen from Pulcinella Shugart, bar number 26511, representing the landowners here, Ivar and Donna Larson, and Dr. Lauren K. Sandberg, who are seated in the court. And with me here at trial counsel table, or counsel table, is Dan Dean of Dean and Reed, who's trial counsel in this matter. Your honors, there are two reasons to reverse this case. One is that the General Assembly has provided no authority for Sinclair Pipeline Company to condemn private property for a high-pressure gasoline pipeline. And the second reason is that the lower courts wrongly ignored public safety in determining the route that this pipeline should take. Now, the public safety issue is certainly the more dramatic, visceral, compelling issue. Remember San Bruno? That was less than 3 months ago, when a natural gas pipeline ruptured and exploded into a wall of flame that reached to the sky. It took Pacific Gas and Electric over an hour to shut off the gas. 8 people died, lots more houses were
burned. Also, sure, these pipelines are regulated for a safety standpoint by a federal agency?
Yes, Your Honor, there is a federal agency, the Department of Transportation, and its sub-agencies that regulate pipelines.
I'm having hard to understand why a jury should take any of that into account, then.
The trial court can take into account safety issues in routing, Your Honor, because routing is not addressed by any federal law or regulation. In fact, federal law says that the Secretary of Transportation shall issue no laws or regulations governing pipeline routing. Routing is the one opportunity that the state of Colorado has through its courts, or through the General Assembly, or through an administrative agency.
Well, if the legislature wanted that to be taken into account, wouldn't they have said so? I mean, this is a condemnation, apparently, for an additional pipeline and an easement that has been there for a long time for the very purpose for which this one was sought.
Certainly, Your Honor, the legislature can say so. The legislature can direct trial courts to consider safety, but there's no reason why it has to. When a trial court is sitting in an immediate possession hearing, it's sitting in equity. This is a matter that's tried to the court under general principles of equity jurisdiction. And public safety, just like public impact, is always something that a court sitting in equity can and should take into consideration, whether or not the General Assembly has specifically directed it to. In a preliminary injunction hearing, you don't have courts saying, well, I could consider public impact, but the General Assembly hasn't directed me to do so. That's not
what you want it on both phases, right? The condemnation award through the jury or the trier of fact, as well as an immediate possession?
In this case, it would be appropriate to raise public safety and the immediate possession hearing regarding the route that the pipeline should take. And then again, public safety evidence was certainly relevant to the issue of the value of the land being condemned, because there was an enormous amount of residual land that these landowners, if not Sinclair, but these landowners, because they take safety seriously, would dedicate to safety setbacks around the pipeline. And the jury, of course, should have heard that.
But in the immediate possession, your position is that the pipeline already in the ground should have been moved.
That's what Ivar Larson at the immediate possession hearing urged, that instead of putting the pipeline right down the middle of his property, that Sinclair simply move it over to the edge of the property.
But the existing one as well.
Yes, that had been paid for moving the existing ones. It'd be that both pipelines along the edge of the property, which would have been, as Mr. Larson put it, in the trial court, that would have been a home run for everyone. It wouldn't have cost Sinclair anything because the Larsons were willing to pay for the moving. They would have had their pipeline and their gasoline would have flowed. But from Mr. Larson's perspective, that's $2 million worth of property that he's able to develop, which we would otherwise have to devote to a safety setback if the pipeline goes down the middle. So that makes perfect sense to have done.
Okay, so one more question, then I'll stand down for my colleagues. So what the safety issue has to do with the existing pipeline as well as the new one, right?
That's right. And I don't spend too much time on safety, Your Honor, because the more compelling...
But that was an easement that was basically negotiated by the predecessors of Mr. Larson, right?
That's correct.
So if there's a setback requirement, you know, why wasn't it taken care of at the time the original one was put in there?
Oh, back in the 60s, not all that much was known, even by the federal safety regulators or any.
And what is the land use regulation that requires a setback in this case?
In this case, there is no applicable regulation that requires any kind of setbacks. The one federal regulation addressing not even setback, the one from the Department of Transportation that applies here simply says that pipelines need to be buried 3 feet, and if they get within 50 feet of an occupied structure, then you got to bury them an extra foot.
So the zoning authorities don't consider there needs to be a setback. Is that right?
In this situation, because the federal regulators have been effectively captured by Sinclair, no, there is no setback.
No, I don't think you heard my question.
Sorry.
I'm talking about the land use authorities, and this is in Weld County, don't have a setback requirement, right?
I believe that's correct.
Okay, so what you're trying to do is inject this concern about safety into a situation to require a setback of Sinclair that's not required by any zoning land use regulation affecting the property, right?
That's right.
I'm just trying to get oriented to your argument.
I'm sorry?
Just trying to get oriented to what you want us to do here.
Yes, sir.
And this would be a radical change to eminent domain law in Colorado, right?
A radical change? Well, on the safety issue, Your Honor, yes, we are recommending, urging the court to take up this issue of the equity court's jurisdiction in an immediate possession hearing to consider issues affecting the routing of pipelines. And the way that this court should do that, Your Honor, is to revisit this doctrine of necessity that says that if a condemnor has authority to condemn, then under the doctrine of necessity, it gets to choose its route, the land that it condemns, and courts don't second-guess that except in the event of fraud or bad faith. What we would urge the court to do is to take that up and reconsider it and substitute something more sensible like a presumption. Of course, there needs to be some kind of judicial review here. It should be deferential. Give the condemnor a presumption that it gets to condemn whatever land it wants to. It chooses its route. But in a situation, especially like this, it's not a zero-sum game. It's not if you push one person out, then it's going to be a problem for somebody else, like it was in the DeLosta case, for instance, when Interstate 70 came through Denver. There, people are going to get pushed out, and if it's not me, then it's going to be somebody else, and that's not a manageable situation for a court to try and decide who. But in this situation, you've got Sinclair, and you've got the Larsons. Sinclair has chosen to condemn property down the middle of the Larsons' land, which completely compromises their ability, not completely, but strongly compromises their ability to develop their land. Mr. Larson proposes an alternative. Put the pipeline along the side, the home run for everybody. It works just as well for Sinclair, won't cost them anything, and it saves Mr. Larson $2 million.
Mr. Gorin, why is it, when you consider that the pipeline perhaps is going through other property, adjacent property, and other property in its route, what about the prospect that was raised by your opposition of requiring zigzagging because of other landowners being affected in some manner as well? And doesn't that move you sort of right back into the analogy to I-70 that you're saying wasn't here?
No, Justice Martinez. It's not the same analogy. In the I-70 analogy, it's a zero-sum problem. Some people are going to get pushed around by I-70, and courts, there's really no manageable way for a court to determine all right, who's going to get pushed out. We leave that kind of situation to the political process. Here, there would be, under what we're suggesting, the possibility of some route changes, but that is not at all unmanageable. For instance, Xcel Energy, which runs the utility line, it runs its utility lines along the side of the Larson's property because that's the sensible place to put it. The utility line's already there. The statute, in fact, 38.1.101.5, directs trial courts to consider utility corridors, which the trial court failed to do here. If it had, the pipeline had gone on the edge of the property in the existing utility corridor, then we would have had all the dangerous pipelines in one place where there would be no construction, no digging, and that along the edge made more sense because there's a natural buffer. There's an irrigation easement, ditch, there's a road. So already you've got some natural buffers built in. Before I spend all my time discussing public safety, Your Honor, I do want to address the more important or more compelling reason to reverse this case, which is the lack of statutory condemnation authority. If the court reverses on that basis, then this court should send us back to the trial court to vacate the orders of condemnation and send us back to collect the landowner's fees for this entire course of litigation. And then the court will be in a position to address the safety issues however it wants to. You can take it up, you can provide guidance, you can comment on it in dicta, and maybe or save it entirely for another day. But the lack of statutory authority completely disposes of this case. Now,
except for all the pipelines that are in the ground that you know have been built in reliance on this statute, I mean, don't we have to give a reasonable reading to the legislative intent? What's the alternative to pipelines to move gas line? Trucks down I-70 or down I-25?
And Your Honor, we're not suggesting that companies like Sinclair can't move their gasoline through pipelines.
Well, how would they do that?
Well, first of all, they don't have
to... Under your construction of the statute.
First of all, they can buy property. They don't have to have the resort to eminent domain to take people's property for it.
Sure, and there's negotiation required, you know, in the condemnation statute before you ever exercise condemnation. We got to assume that that doesn't work. So what's next?
It doesn't work because Mr. Larson, because the...
I'm talking about your view of what the legislature did in the statute.
Okay.
Trying to make some sense of what the legislative intent is, which is our duty.
Right.
Your argument is it excludes gasoline pipelines, correct?
That's correct. And, of course, Sinclair has legislative redress. They can, and if this court decides that the legislature has not...
So the legislature intended that what alternate vehicle would be used to move gasoline?
The legislature has never addressed gasoline transportation in any condemnation statute. Never. There is no legislative intent existing for this court to work with. The statutes only supply legislative intent for, in this case, it's electrical infrastructure. That's what the legislative intent is in 38.5105. So Sinclair has the ability, of course, to seek legislative redress. It can, and I'm sure it will, go to the General Assembly.
Surprising result for a state that's born with its natural resources being developed and as the foundation for the state in a lot of ways.
Which is why I'm sure that once this court reads the statute and hopefully correctly construes them, that the legislature can then take up and establish this right of condemnation for gasoline pipelines, and we may be back here in a few more years. But in order to get there, you've got to be convinced that the existing condemnation statutes do not cover gasoline pipelines. So let me take you through, very briefly, Your Honors, a little over a century of condemnation statutes involving pipelines. Now, we've laid this out most directly in our reply brief on the condemnation statutes. And at the end, where we, after having gone through all of the statutes, we provide the court with a chart. It's on page 24 of our reply brief. It looks like this. And if the court has hard copies or electronic devices, page 24 of our reply brief. What I would like to do, Your Honors, is just walk through this chart chronologically. It goes from the top down chronologically to show exactly what statutes have been enacted and what haven't been. We start in 1877, first iteration of statutes in Colorado. Back then, the General Assembly would pass statutes for each type of company. Some of those companies had eminent domain power. And there was a statute, the predecessor of 38.2101, which listed all the companies that had eminent domain power. And those companies were road, ditch, bridge, ferry, tunnel, telegraph, or railroad. No pipelines at all back in 1877. 6 years later, in 1883, the next set of mill statutes repletes the same statute that lists the companies that have eminent domain power. Again, still no pipelines. Then in 1885, we have the first statute that's relevant here. That's when the General Assembly enacted, let's say, a precursor statute to the one at issue, for electrical infrastructure. Denver was an early adopter of electric lighting, and this is for electrical infrastructure. It's a statute that has condemnation authority for telephone, telegraph, and electric light lines, because back then, electric lighting was those were the only three applications of electricity. So we have an electrical infrastructure statute that includes a condemnation provision. Still no pipelines. Forward now to 1891. That was the year that the General Assembly enacted the first pipeline condemnation statute. It's the predecessor of the modern 743-102. In fact, the language is identical to its 19th century origins. It's a statute that grants condemnation power for pipelines that carry gas, water, and oil, not gasoline. And it also has certain other things that make it inapplicable to Sinclair. It's only for domestic companies, and it requires companies who use the statute to specify the route of the pipeline in their articles of incorporation. Sinclair specifically disclaimed any reliance on this in the trial court and is not claiming it currently up here because it doesn't apply. But that is a pipeline condemnation statute, and it doesn't apply here. Now, on the same day, in fact, in 1891, after enacting this new pipeline condemnation statute, the legislature amended the earlier statute that lists all of the types of companies that have condemnation authority to add pipeline companies. So the listing statute isn't where the condemnation authority comes from. That just is the way of keeping track, and it adds pipeline companies. Now we move 16 years forward to 1907. That's the year that the legislature repealed the earlier 1885 electrical infrastructure statute and enacted the new one, which is 385101, with subsection 105 having the condemnation authority. The statute that the legislature enacted was for telephone, telegraph, and electric light lines in the original bill, just the same as before. The legislature then amended the statute to say electric light or power or pipeline company. In this context, pipeline means pipelines for burying high voltage electric lines, because by 1907, now we've got electric power lines being strung up on phone poles. High voltage, dangerous. Power companies were starting to bury these lines in underground pipelines. That is what pipeline meant. And if there were any doubt about that application, there was an amendment. We give the legislative journal and the tabs of our briefs, which shows that one senator proposed an amendment to extend the pipelines to include pipelines for carrying oil or other commodities. That proposed amendment was voted down.
Well, maybe it's because it said pipelines and pipeline companies. Well, what else happened in the early 20th century? The automobile that consumes gasoline, correct? I mean, it's around the same time, right?
That's around the same time. But when you read, there's the language, electric light or power or pipeline company, as we argue. Electric is modifying light and power and pipeline here. And it's the only way that the language makes sense, the original 1907 language. Additionally, in 1907, the legislature enacted another pipeline condemnation statute specifically for mining purposes that granted condemnation power for pipelines that carry power, water, air, or gas. Now, if the legislature had intended the one statute at issue here, 385105, to be any kind of pipeline, including gasoline, it wouldn't, in the same session, have enacted another statute giving condemnation power for a specific type of pipeline, power, water, air, or gas, if every type of pipeline was covered in 385105. Another reason to construe that statute as pertaining to electrical infrastructure. And now, if we move 56 years ahead to 1963, and we've got the only amendment to the statute at issue, that is when the General Assembly took up an amendment to 385101 and 105 to add cities and towns to the companies that were entitled to use the statute to condemn. And there was an additional amendment to add natural gas, to add gas to the definition. And that passed, and now gas is part of the definition. And the General Assembly dropped the word gas in the definition, right in between electric light. It used to be electric light or power or pipeline company, meaning electrical infrastructure. The legislature put the word gas right in the middle of that definition, so it became electric light, power, gas, or pipeline company. It was inartful, but as we point out in a brief, clearly the legislature didn't, by surgically, precisely putting the word gas where it did, intend to change the entire meaning, to change pipeline from being electrical infrastructure to being any pipeline at all. The legislature doesn't play those kind of games with language where you insert one word and by doing it just there, you change the meaning of the statute completely. So that is a history of a century of condemnation statute, and we submit, Your Honors, that it establishes without any doubt, and in a way that I think all the members of this court can agree, the General Assembly did not enact a statute for gasoline pipelines, giving them condemnation power. When the court looks at context, the greater statutory scheme, and for purposes of greater statutory scheme, just take a look two sections down. Look at 38.5.107. That's part of this electrical infrastructure statute, and it goes into great detail, talking about rules of priority for pipelines, for wires. It's very difficult to read because it was written in 1907, but it's clearly talking about underground construction of putting wires and pipelines for electrical infrastructure. Look at context, statutory scheme, and historical development, which, you know, just 2 days ago in the Drewer residence case, People v. White, that this court handed down, reviewing statutory construction. That's what the court focused on. We're not urging here some kind of tortured reading of statutory language. This is just basic context, statutory scheme, and history. And it should lead this court to the conclusion that 38.5.105 is for electrical infrastructure and was never intended by the General Assembly to create a right for condemnation for gasoline pipelines. Now, briefly about safety, which we started out on, Your Honor. I'm going to let the pictures do the talking about safety. So, Justice Hobbs, if you think to allay your concerns about whether we should just defer all of this to federal regulation, let me show you the pictures. These are Sinclair's safety brochures. Sinclair is required by the weak federal regulations that exist to have a public safety program, and it has produced these brochures as part of that. It gives these safety brochures to homeowners in the areas of its pipelines.
Mr. Cullen, yes. I think there was a suggestion in the Sinclair brief that anything to do with regulations was preempt under, you know, the federal law preempts state law. So what's your position about that?
Regarding preemption, Your Honor?
Yes, federal preemption, yes.
That federal preemption preempts almost everything. Once the pipeline is in the ground and the hydrocarbons are flowing, then yes. Regulation is entirely up to the federal government, its Office of Pipeline Safety. Those regulators are, as we point out, pretty much captured here, which is why you've got pipelines running through. We're not urging this court to try and take on federal preemption. Rather, what we're urging this court to do is to be mindful of the fact that pipeline routing is not preempted. Now, it's easy, since preemption is pretty broad, to think, well, the route that the pipeline takes, that must be preempted too, but it's not. As we point out in our briefs, it's 49 U.S.C. section 60104 sub E specifically says that the federal law at issue does not authorize the Secretary of Transportation to prescribe the location or routing of a pipeline facility.
Well, that's just something right, though. I mean, we've got plenty of regulatory schemes that have to do with the safety of the public, you know, toxic waste dumps, you know, all these kinds of concerns, land use, zoning, etc. What gives a court in a condemnation authority to consider this kind of evidence you're talking about? Why don't you go to the, you know, the state agency that regulates gasoline or health and safety concerns, or the Weld County Commissioners?
Your Honor, some states do it that way. For instance, I just learned recently that Minnesota has a fairly elaborate regulatory scheme governing pipeline regulation, where there's an administrative agency that holds hearings, invites public comment, makes recommendations. Colorado's nothing like that. So what gives Colorado the authority to look at pipeline safety and routing is a trial court's inherent equitable authority to consider public impact and public safety. Now, if the General Assembly were to say in 38.1101.5, instruct trial courts, don't consider public safety, well then, actually then there'd be a serious separation of powers issue, because that's part of a court's inherent problem, but the General Assembly hasn't done that. A trial court does not need to seek permission from the legislature to consider public safety in an equitable proceeding. It can consider it. The real problem here is this judicially created doctrine of necessity, under which once a condemning authority, a condemnor has authority, gets to choose its location without any judicial oversight. That's what creates the problem here, but we would urge the courts to take this issue up and refine that standard to allow for some judicial review. It can be deferential. We would suggest something in the nature of a presumption. There's a presumption that Sinclair gets to choose its route, and some presumptions are not going to be easily rebutted, especially if it's a zero-sum game, and it's not going to do the court any good to get involved.
Mr. Cohen, may I interrupt one second? We've done a lot about changing routes and whether they should have and what you all wanted to propose, but is the issue here whether the landowner's evidence of valuation of his property was excluded?
That is not an issue that the court has taken cert on. It is a grievous error. Now, the court's in this case, it could remand for a new valuation trial or remand to for a do-over from the beginning.
Well, with regard then to the question about rerouting or choosing the route, what's the trial court's error?
The trial court's error was in not considering public safety. If you read the immediate possession hearing transcript, the places we point out, the trial court said repeatedly, don't talk to me about safety. I'm not concerned about public safety. I'm going to basically ask Sinclair to put the pipeline wherever it wants.
So you're not trying to argue here that the trial court improperly excluded evidence. You're arguing that its ultimate determination was what? Unsupported by the evidence?
We're arguing that the trial court erred in not considering safety. We had evidence that it would have protected public safety much better had the trial court put this pipeline along the edge of the property, and it would have also impacted the valuation trial, because then instead of having a huge safety setback on both sides of the pipeline, it would have been just one side of the pipeline. About $2 million worth of the Larson and Sandberg property would have been preserved for development, and it wouldn't have been any detriment to Sinclair. Its gasoline would have still flowed down its pipeline into Rolling Hills, where it does go right next to, you know, within 24 feet of houses and practically underneath the school bus stop. Your Honor, I only have a few more minutes, so I'm going to save that for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Respondents?
Good morning. Jack Sperber appearing on behalf of Sinclair Transportation Company. With me at counsel's table is Brandy Caswell, who was involved in the trial court proceedings with me and extensively involved in the briefs. Sarah Maffler is in the courtroom as well. She's been extensively involved in the case. And finally, two of my client representatives, Mr. David Stice and Mark Peterson, are here from Sinclair. I'd like to start with discussing some of the safety issues as well. And I think it may be helpful to take a step back and look at some of the issues that have been raised by the petitioners in a broader context, and specifically within where it fits within the rubric of eminent domain law. Because I found that the longer I specialize in this little area, the more I have to guard against getting down into the details too quickly and not conveying how this fits into the broad picture. And Justice Hoffman, many of your questions, I think, illustrate that you understand where this case fits. As much as the petitioners would like to be able to present certain evidence and certain issues in this case, this is a special statutory proceeding. Eminent domain proceedings have been controlled by jurisprudence dating back over 100 years, dictating what issues are properly considered in these cases and what issues aren't. Now, the issue with respect to safety that review was granted on was whether a specific statute, 381.101.5, requires a trial court in a condemnation proceeding to consider safety issues in determining whether the most direct route practicable was followed. As to that specific issue, petitioners have conceded that the statute doesn't require that. Their reply brief specifically says that they agree that the statute doesn't lend itself to a judicial interpretation that requires that consideration. So I think that largely answers the issue that's in front of the court. Nonetheless, the petitioners go on and talk about all sorts of reasons why they think the court should consider those issues and raise concerns about safety, raise concerns about the evidentiary issues which they've acknowledged the court hasn't granted review on, and get to the end game of what they're really looking for here, which is a do-over to present again at the trial court evidence that they weren't allowed to present, primarily for valuation purposes, because of a variety of procedural and evidentiary errors. And Justice Hoff, you asked about the necessity standard, and maybe not by name, but asking about what empowers trial courts to consider these issues in a condemnation case. And there is over 100 years of jurisprudence and many cases issued by this court, which simply says trial courts in condemnation cases aren't empowered to decide those issues. Because the necessity standard is an element that has to be determined in each condemnation case. And as Mr. Cohen rightfully indicated, there's a great deference given to that standard and the decisions that are made by the condemning agencies. And so absent a showing of fraud or bad faith in deciding that alignment, no facts of which are found in this case, courts aren't even supposed to inquire into those things. And there's good reasons for that, because, Justice Martinez, I think you asked this question about the I-70 example. All of these lineal projects, whether they are a public highway or whether they're an oil pipeline or an electric transmission line, any lineal project falls victim to second guessing by lawyers and courtrooms and judges. And it does lead to things like this zigzagging around through properties. It becomes a practical impossibility to build these kind of projects if condemnation powers don't exist and if each of these projects is subject to second guessing. It's not a simple issue, as the petitioners would suggest, of looking at just Mr. Larson or Mr. Sandberg's property and deciding about a little realignment on that property, because that has impacts up and down the line. Moreover, if these landowners in this case are allowed to engage in a second guessing exercise about the alignment, then every single property owner up and down the line is entitled to that same second guessing, and these pipelines simply couldn't be built. Now, they suggest in their briefs that the necessity standard...
Why couldn't they be built without second-guessing? I mean, it's not like a highway where the straight line is a lot more important and you can't make a turn very quickly. So it does seem to me that there may be some zigzagging, but is there anything at all to indicate that that's highly problematic?
Well, I think it is problematic to zigzag with pipelines just as it is with highways, and highways can have turns and twists in them as well. But the desirability from both a safety standpoint with the traveling public and from a construction standpoint is to have those highways as straight as possible.
Right, but from your standpoint, it seems to me, without being more informed about the specifics of it, that it's not so much a matter of public safety, it's just a cost issue. In other words, you'd be traveling gas would be traveling a greater distance.
Well, I think there is some cost issues associated with the traveling a greater distance. There are some cost issues associated with the line weaving back and forth, and what that may mean in terms of consequential impacts, I guess, is the way I would characterize it. You've got an alignment moving, and now if it shifts on one property, you're weaving back and forth, and that has implications in terms of sometimes permitting, in terms of construction schedules and other things that are a much broader impact than that. I'm not an expert in pipeline engineering issues, but I also think that the more turns and twists there are in the pipeline, that's typically where the pressure points are. And so the more turns you have, the more risk there is of there being corrosion or there being other impacts that cause the types of safety issues that they're expressing concerns about. And so there are reasons for it to be straight, both from a cost standpoint and a safety standpoint. I want to also address this idea, though, that the necessity standard shouldn't apply to private companies. And that's something that at least was argued in their briefs, that this idea has been developed as a political question issue and only applies to public entities, not private entities. They don't cite any case law to support that, and I can tell you that there are cases that support the opposite proposition in the sense that it's private condemnors in which this court and other courts have imposed the necessity standard. We cited a couple of those in our answer brief, the Schneider v. Schneider case and the Mortensen case, both of which involved private entities condemning right-of-way or other property for water infrastructure. There's a number of other cases dealing with utilities and telegraph and telephone lines and railroads that also imply the standard. So I think there's simply no support for that. But I want to make one thing clear before I move off of safety. This is not a situation where Sinclair doesn't care about safety or that it's trying to downplay or discount the importance of public safety. It's Sinclair's absolute goal and objective to safely deliver fuel products to the marketplace. It doesn't want to be the next San Bruno. And in part, new pipelines like this help to prevent against that because it's the old pipelines that typically fail, not the new lines. So they put considerable time, money, and resources into ensuring the safety. And it's frankly an insult to people like Mark Peterson and David Stice to suggest that they don't care about those things. And I think this court, if it's concerned about that, can take judicial notice of Sinclair's safety record by going to places like the Office of Pipeline Safety's website and looking at reported incidents or the relative lack thereof with respect to Sinclair. So that's not what we're arguing about, and that's frankly why we didn't spend much time responding in the brief to some of the safety issues.
Before you move off this linear argument
Yes.
that you've made, isn't there sort of a preference anyway in the industry and in condemnation to have it put in the same easement if there's a right-of-way already?
There is.
I mean, you have the easement going both directions, I assume, for this existing pipeline. You're laying it in the basically the same trench that you can uncover for maintenance and safety checks and things like that.
That's right, Your Honor. And I think it is important to remember that this case doesn't involve a virgin easement being acquired across new lands. This case involves an existing easement that was on this property and other properties extending over 100 miles dating back to 1967. And so what was being acquired in this case was simply the right to install a second pipeline within that easement. Many of the easements that were originally granted back in the 1960s carried with them the right to install multiple pipelines already. This was one alluding to the negotiations that you talked about earlier, where apparently the original owners of the property negotiated an exclusion for a single pipeline. So Sinclair had to come back in this circumstance and buy a second pipeline right when we couldn't reach agreement with Mr. Larson and the Sandbergs about that condemnation had to proceed. And just to respond to one last issue about that point, since you raised it, the petitioners have argued that they had offered to pay for the cost of this relocation, so it was essentially no skin off of Sinclair's nose. That's not exactly right. The evidence in the record reveals that what they asked Sinclair to do is to move both its existing pipeline, which I think, as you've suggested earlier, there was no requirement to move. It was already there, as well as construct a new pipeline around the periphery of the property. They still asked for $700,000 in compensation for us to move to that location based on the theory that there would be setbacks there, that it would affect 28 supposed residential lots that would someday be built on this property and that somehow were being affected. And what they offered to offset against that $700,000 was a contribution to the relocation cost, which Mr. Larson made his own estimate about what that cost was, roughly half of what Sinclair said that it would be. So it simply wasn't a win-win situation that was being offered, and frankly, that's part of what led to the condemnation. I'd like to shift now, unless there's other questions about the safety issues, and talk a little bit about the statutory authority to condemn. In this court, for the first time, the petitioners argue that 385105 doesn't apply to all pipeline companies generally, but instead it applies to something, frankly, of their own invention called an electric pipeline company. And it's a clever argument, and they spent a lot of time and energy, obviously, walking through various statutes and the history of those statutes to get to that location. But I think we all have to step back and check that interpretation against the current statutory language and to check that interpretation against reality. The current statutory interpretation or the current statute simply cannot be interpreted to apply to electric pipeline companies because, as they admit, this term gas gets in the way. It's right in the middle of their electric pipeline company argument and is separated by commas and renders that kind of interpretation impossible. So they suggest that somehow that was a mistake, that it was somehow inartful. Well, first, I question that conclusion because This same mistake appears in six different places within Article 5 in the same exact way. Second, of course, your job is to review the statute as it currently stands and to give those words their plain and ordinary meaning. And when you do that, it can't mean electric pipeline company. Moreover, there's no indication that there ever was or is now a such thing as an electric pipeline company. It's certainly true that electric lines are sometimes undergrounded, but they're not placed in pipelines per se, and they're not named as electric pipeline companies. And they haven't cited to you a single statute anywhere, a single case anywhere, or a single historical text anywhere which suggests there is such a thing as an electric pipeline company.
Can I interrupt right there?
Yes.
Assuming, taking where you're going with that, and that's too narrow an explanation of what pipeline company would mean. Nevertheless, you have pipeline company as the last of a series of things, all of which are utility of some kind, something to move through pipeline companies, and then you have pipeline company. Is there, following general rules of construction, would one be inclined to interpret pipeline company then to mean only the kind of pipeline that would carry or facilitate those kind of utilities rather than any kind of a pipe?
I'm honestly not sure I fully understand your question, Justice Cook.
You're explaining why it doesn't make sense, why you dispute the argument that pipeline should refer only to electric. But why shouldn't it refer only to telegraph, telephone, electric, light power, gas?
Well, I think they're different concepts. I think each of those terms actually modify the last phrase, company, as opposed to modifying pipeline itself, if I understand your question. So
each of those initial antecedents, though, needs to be carried by a pipeline here, by a pipe.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'm not sure that's accurate.
Ah, okay. So you're suggesting here then that these telegraph or telephone could be condemning land to be used in some way other than carrying those things through a pipeline.
That's right. And just a nitpicking issue, telegraph and telephones, those were ultimately amended out of this statutory provision, and a new statute was adopted that allows for that. I can't give you the site right now, but it's within the same section of 38.1.101. But subject to that little clarification, I don't think the intent of this statute was to limit the pipeline at all. And I think historically, electric infrastructure in particular, is generally placed overhead. Telegraph and telephone lines have generally been placed overhead. Pipelines tend to be underground, obviously, and tend to address a broader series of commodities.
So you've got combined in one series here then some means of facilitating power or electricity or something, and also any kind of pipes that would go under the ground.
Yeah, I think actually the present day title helps to explain the purpose of the statute. It refers to rights of way for transmission companies, and I think all of these companies meet that definition.
Are pipeline companies transmission companies?
I think they are, certainly in this context.
Would they have to be, or are you saying even if they weren't, they would fit within the definition of pipeline?
Well, I think they would fit within the definition of pipeline regardless. I think that most pipelines meet that definition. They're transmitting some product over a distance. And so I think that pipeline company has an understood meaning, and that's what we're really suggesting to you, is that you recognize that this statute grants rights to pipeline companies and that the job for this court is to say, what does that mean? In this context specifically, is that term broad enough to include oil and gas facilities?
I ask you just one more on that.
Yes.
Then it would seem that if that's what they meant, it would seem that pipeline company would have been enough, for instance, to take into account gas being transmitted through a pipeline company without expressly amending the statute for gas.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
And I think that there are a number of companies that transmit gas through pipelines that could have condemned under the original language just pipeline companies. I don't know why gas was added specifically in 1963 with that amendment. We don't have any legislative record that indicates that. But as we've suggested in the brief, there can be companies that transmit gas that meet the definition of pipeline companies, but there are also gas companies that may not meet the definition of pipeline company. And so gas modifies the term company just as electric company, electric power company, and pipeline company modify that term. There are some things that are different about gas companies potentially that are different than pipeline companies in the pure sense of a transmission company. Because some gas companies store gas, they distribute gas, and there are additional facilities associated with that. And along with the reference to gas in the 1963 amendment was a reference to regulator stations that was added. That's something that may relate just to a gas company as opposed to a pipeline company. So that's at least a partial explanation for what those amendments address. But you can look at broader things to decide whether pipeline companies are included within, I'm sorry, that oil and gas companies are included within the definition of pipeline company. And while the Court of Appeals didn't have as much of a basis to work off of as we've provided in these briefs, because frankly, this was not a significant issue in the lower court briefings, the general parameters that they laid out, I think, make sense. And they started with a dictionary definition of pipeline company. And pipelines themselves are defined as a line of pipe for conveying liquids, gases, and finely divided solids. They then looked at what the legislature may have intended, and they pointed to other statutes. One of them was 743-102, which was adopted prior to this statute being adopted in 1907, and expressly contemplates the transmission of oil through pipelines, in that case by domestic pipeline corporations. There are a number of other statutes. If you do a search in Colorado statutes in the fall, you'll find 13 different statutes referencing pipeline companies that transmit oil and gas through the pipelines. And the amicus briefs tell you, and Justice Hobbs, you alluded to this earlier, that this is a commonly understood term in the industry, that the oil and gas industry understands pipeline companies to be transporters of oil, gas, and petroleum products through pipelines. Thousands of miles of oil and gas pipelines are in this state right now, and the oil and gas industry, again, the amicus tell you, traditionally condemn under Article 5 to acquire those rights. Finally, the legislative history associated with 381-101.5, the statute that's been discussed in the context of safety issues, reveals that various pipeline companies appeared in front of the legislature, all talking about the transmission of oil and gas through their pipelines when that statute was adopted. So there's plenty of evidence that the legislature understood this term to include oil and gas pipeline companies. And I don't think, frankly, that it's necessary for the court to define the outer parameters of what this term may mean. I think you can take a narrow view and simply decide that oil and gas pipeline companies fall within this definition. If you want to take a broader view, I think the dictionary definition is as good as any place to start. It's a company that transmits liquids, gases, or finely divided solids through pipelines. And you can come up with absurd examples, obviously. They used an example of Coors shipping beer through a pipeline as the dangers that come from that kind of an interpretation. But Justice Coates, we actually cited to your concurring opinion in Stapleton case to answer that, which is that those absurd examples can generally be dealt with through an application of the public use or public purpose clause of the Constitution. That's distinct from statutory authority to condemn. It's a separate job of the courts to look at whether a public purpose is truly being served. And so the court can deal with those types of absurd examples when and if they come up later. And just because maybe to respond a little more fully to your questions about, as I understood it, a lack of specific reference to other commodities or the reference to gas, perhaps, in the statute and what that may mean. I don't think that excludes any other product from being transmitted through the pipelines, particularly the way this statute was drafted. And I think, frankly, it would be a false assumption to require a specific reference to every commodity that has to
That'd be quite a job, wouldn't it? I mean, you'd have to add coal slurry. What else could you move through a pile? I mean, the legislature would have to keep going every time some new product is put in the pipeline.
Somebody would have to amend the statute to allow for that specific thing if you were to follow their interpretation. And it would actually be the equivalent of saying that the Department of Transportation can't condemn for state highways under the highway condemnation statute because it doesn't specifically reference hybrid or electric vehicles going along the highway in the statute itself. Nobody would suggest that that precludes the condemnation for highways by the Department of Transportation. And in fact, this court, as you know, has interpreted that language relating to state highway purposes very broadly to allow condemnation for things like parking facilities, mass transit purposes, and those kinds of things.
Could I follow up on, since we're sort of back to this phraseology about the pipeline company mm-hmm. again, since oil and gas companies are not listed in the listing of commodities, presumably you all would qualify as having a right to condemn here only as being a pipeline company. Is that right? I mean, whereas a gas company would presumably qualify whether they're laying pipeline or not because they're listed as gas, or an electric company similarly.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Do you think, I take it by that then, what you'd mean is a pipeline company, assuming we mean any commodity that it might be using to transmit, that you would qualify as a pipeline company if you lay pipes, regardless of whether that's your primary function or not, would a certain percentage of your business have to be involved in laying pipeline to qualify as being a pipeline company? Or do you think it means any purveyor of some commodity if they in some time or another lay pipeline?
I guess I can. We haven't thought about it in the context of how much of your business has to be a pipeline company. Some of the other statutes, 38.4 and 38.2, that also address this, 38.2 in particular talks about this much more broadly, of any company formed for the purpose, among other things, of installing pipelines can condemn for rights of way for those facilities or for any other purpose associated with it. So certainly that statute, which is an alternative basis, incidentally, along with 38.4102, that this court could affirm Sinclair's condemnation powers under. Certainly that statute talks about it much more broadly. I don't see a real reason to treat 38.5105 differently than that and somehow look at the total percentage of a company's business. I think the fundamental issue is somebody acquiring right-of-way in order to construct, operate, or maintain pipelines for the transport of a certain commodity? And if that can be a demonstrated purpose, I think they have condemnation powers under this article. Again, we could come up with some absurd examples of a situation that is, you know, a company that's just condemning for a purely private purpose to advance their own business objectives, and the public purpose clause is the backstop to that, but not the transmission of the natural resources of this state to bring them to market and to develop those resources. That's clearly met the definition of public purpose, and this court's recognized that in the Chase Pipeline Company case. This is also worth noting that this particular pipeline has been deemed a common carrier by FERC, meaning that anybody else who wants to put product through this pipeline upon the payment of reasonable rates and meeting other conditions could use it. That meets the strictest definition of public use, so I simply don't think that kind of a thing is at play here. Have I addressed your issue with that? One other point is maybe worth discussing just briefly, because there were a lot of comments made about it in oral argument, to the Section 107. And specifically some proposed legislative amendments that referenced pipelines and some specific commodities back in that time frame. I think it's important to understand what Section 107 addresses. I'm talking about 38.5107 as opposed to the broader statute, because I think it disproves petitioner's theories. That section deals only with high voltage electric transmission line crossings. And it's notable that that section contains no reference to pipes, no reference to other power. Because if this statute and this whole article was really designed to deal with electric facilities only, as petitioners contend, then pipes would be listed in that statute just as they are in every other section. It's not there, and it's not there because pipelines are designed to serve another purpose in this statute. And the specific amendment that they point to was essentially a wholesale deletion of the original version of Section 107 and a replacement of that section. It wasn't offering up a specific change to the definition of pipeline throughout the statute. Within that wholesale replacement, there was this reference to oil, gas, or other commodity or power. The whole proposed amendment was not accepted, presumably because the legislature ultimately said this section deals with high voltage electric transmission line crossings. There's no need to reference pipelines in that section. But I think it's indicative of what the legislature was probably thinking pipes were going to be used for as enumerated in this statute: oil, gas, or other power or commodities. And it really supports the broad view of pipeline company that we're advocating for. Unless the court has other questions for me, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Ms. Cohen, do you have any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by addressing some of the statutory arguments that were made by Mr. Sperber. Mr. Sperber is arguing that the placement of gas in the 1963 amendment renders our interpretation impossible. Exactly the opposite is true. The way the legislature in 1963 placed gas in the middle of an otherwise coherent definition actually compels our interpretation. In 1963, the definition was telephone, telegraph, electric light or power or pipeline company shall have condemnation power. There, electric modifies light, power, and pipeline. So the legislature was talking about pipelines being used for electrical infrastructure purposes. In 1963, when the General Assembly put the word gas in the middle of that, it became electric light power, comma, gas, comma, or pipeline company. It was awkwardly done, inartfully done, but by putting gas right in the middle of that definition, it's absurd to think of the General Assembly somehow broke pipeline off from its moorings to electrical infrastructure and thereby made it some free-form, freestanding pipeline condemnation statute. That's what we argue. The legislature doesn't play games like that. It's not like one of those mind teaser puzzles where you move one thing and it's something completely different.
Don't ignore reality either. And President Eisenhower, who was well associated with Colorado, the interstate highway system, yes, opened up the entire country, fueled by petroleum products,
right,
that need to be brought into metropolitan areas and not transported truck by truck, need to be put in facilities. And I'm finding your argument, you know, very technical and not historically placed with your arguing history. And it ignores what the General Assembly plainly knew at the time they're doing this legislation in 63.
Your concerns, Justice Hobbs, must be considered against the backdrop of the constitutional dimension of condemnation law. This court just recently reviewed in the Department of Transportation versus Gypsum Ranch case that it handed down just 2 days ago the basic premises of condemnation law. It is dormant until the legislature speaks.
I don't question that at all. I'm questioning your interpretation of what the legislature intended.
We are not contending. Now, you pointed out, Justice Hobbs, that it would be awfully cumbersome if the legislature had to specify, you know, by each type of stuff that goes through pipelines, that there's going to be condemnation power. Legislature doesn't have to do it that way. The legislature could pass a general purpose pipeline statute. Our argument is that it hasn't done so yet. Back in the 19th century, the General Assembly used to pass specific laws relating to each type of company. It doesn't do that anymore. We have general corporate laws. But along with that, with those early, you know, 19th century definitions extending into the early 20th century, was condemnation powers being allocated to specific types of pipeline companies were based on what was going through. We've got condemnation statutes focusing on gas, oil, air, power, but never, and the one at issue here was clearly electrical infrastructure. The legislature can enact a general purpose pipeline statute, just the way that it's got general corporate statutes now and no longer passes, you know, has to pass a specific type of statute for every type of corporation. But it hasn't done so yet. And until the legislature speaks, this court cannot infer to say we presume that that's what the legislature would have wanted. The legislature has to expressly say so. Otherwise, under the Constitution, the landowner's property can't get taken that way. We therefore urge the court to remand this case with orders vacating the condemnation decisions and remand it for a determination of the landowner's costs and fees incurred throughout the entire course of the litigation. Thank you.
Court thanks both parties for your argument. The case will stand submitted, and we are in recess.